Hi, Marco Werman here. 2022 is just around the corner. Our team at The World has so many stories we plan to bring you in the new year. More stories from more places, more deep dive investigations, more music from around the globe, and more of the nuanced, human-centered international reporting you rely on. You've heard me say it here before, we just can't do it alone. We need your help. To everyone who has already donated to our fundraiser this year, thank you so much. Your support means everything. We are still short of our goal, but luckily our deadline has been extended. We have until December 31st to raise $67,000. As of right now, we're halfway there. If you haven't donated yet, please make your gift today to help power the world for another year. You can donate at theworld.org/give. Thank you, and now the show.
The following message is brought to you by Wise, the smart way to move money internationally. An American sends money to a friend in Australia. An Australian buys from an Indian shop online. An Indian freelancer gets paid by a client in Germany. What do all these people have in common? They use Wise, which means they always get the real exchange rate and super low fees when managing their money across borders. And you will too. Wise has a multi-currency debit card, so you can avoid high fees when you shop overseas, online, or in-store. Wise is designed by international people for international people. Try Wise for free at wise.com/world.
Hello, I'm Alana Gordon. I'm a reporter at The World covering global health. Here at The World, we've been taking your questions to the experts in a regular series of coronavirus conversations. These conversations are in collaboration with The Forum at Harvard's T.H. Chan School of Public Health. The whole series is featured on our Facebook page, but we wanted to share what we think are really valuable conversations with you right here in The World's podcast feed. This week, I spoke with Kerestin Conan. She's a professor of psychiatric epidemiology at Harvard's T.H. Chan School of Public Health, and we talked about the pandemic's toll on children's mental health. So, Kerestin, we have been, as I mentioned, checking in throughout the pandemic on this issue. Kids and teens are actually experiencing a lot more anxiety and depression. That's what recent studies have found compared to before the pandemic, and also more mental health emergencies. The country's leading pediatric health groups have even said it's a national emergency. So something's going on. Omicron, this new variant, adds new uncertainties in general in this moment. One can imagine that can only add more anxiety, both for kids and adults. And yet at the same time, in the US, life is more normal compared to last year. Kids are in school, plus those young as five can now get vaccinated. So to kick things off, I wanted to ask if you could give a snapshot of where we are now with children's mental health, and then how that's feeding into the long-term impacts of this pandemic on mental health of kids.
Sure. Thanks, Alana, and thanks for covering this. So as you said, things are much more back to normal. And you said school, but you know, sports teams are playing. I can see outside, you know, it's outside my house, I can see kids getting together. So that's all really encouraging. But one thing we have found is that the rates of mental health problems among kids, particularly depression and anxiety, have doubled during the pandemic. We already had seen an increase in depression and anxiety in these younger cohorts before the pandemic. The problems preceded it, but it looks like the pandemic doubled these problems, which about 1 in 4 kids experiencing depression and 1 in 5 anxiety, and also reports of increased behavior problems, especially in children with ADHD or autism, and substance use increases in teens, expressing more anger and irritability. We're looking at different age groups of kids, it really seems that the teens have been most affected, even with things going back to normal. In some of the younger age groups, we see that as things get back to normal, the kids, kind of their symptoms seem to be going down as life normalizes, but for teens, the problems seem more persistent. And then also kids who had mental health problems before or other conditions, they also seem to be struggling. So it's a tough time. And I think, parents and schools are really bearing the brunt of it.
Mm. I want to get back to maybe doing an arc or thinking about age. for really young kids, they might not even remember what life was like before the pandemic. And so I wonder if there's an effect of this changing of experiences, whether it's masking or social distancing, fewer precautions or shifting. And what do we know about how that impacts younger kids?
Well, I mean, looking at the data, unfortunately, most of the data we have is on kids 10 and older. But what we do have on younger kids, it seems like actually younger kids are adapting well. And I think part of it is that younger kids take their cues from their parents and their caregivers. Mm-hmm. And with going back to school or daycare, parents have like seen sometimes increased clinginess. So a kid who had adjusted to school or daycare might have to readjust. And especially if they're sort of like have to be home and there's increased family stress because now your kid has a cold, they have to stay home till they get a COVID test, you know, there's disruptions. So that may cause some transient, you know, clinginess and distress. But the younger kids seem to be doing okay. They seem to have to be, you know, remarkably resilient to all this change, particularly if their family has adequate support, the caregivers have adequate support. And some are even saying, you know, the kids like the increased family time, even though it can be tough on parents. They kind of appreciate the increased home time with their families.
And then going towards, you know, kids who are 10 or middle school aged, you know, a lot of teachers and are reporting that they're seeing more disruptive behavior in school. And I wonder what you think is driving this or what schools and parents can do to support staff or address this.
I think that's exactly right. We're seeing more the school age kids and then going into the early teen years, more disruptive behaviors and also just increased kids who struggled with learning or other social problems before the pandemic. That's all gotten worse over the last year. And I think the primary thing is schools need more resources. A lot of the brunt of this is falling on schools, and schools need resources to stay open, to make sure that the teachers and the kids feel safe and reduce risk of COVID infection, like providing masks or a rapid test for schools, funding for that. And also to address the increased needs from the pandemic, such as mental health and behavioral problems. And so resources to hire more school counselors, establish referral networks, and support teachers who are dealing with their own concerns and fears. So I think giving more support and resources to schools is critical to help them deal with these problems. Again, many which were there, but now they've just been aggravated now that kids are back and have had a long disruption in their schooling.
And you mentioned as kids get older, they may be feeling the effects of this pandemic more so. I wonder also, you know, when you think about anxiety and depression going up and some of the other issues that may be sustained, whether it's kind of the stress of uncertainty, what are these signs and symptoms? Like what is happening? I wonder if we could maybe just set like some language around this or what we're even keeping an eye on.
Right. So kids, right. I mean, so even before the pandemic, the younger teens and like tweens and teens were reporting more anxiety and depression. So what does that look like? So kids report being much more worried about everything, worried about themselves or school, their friends, but also things like the world. Younger kids today report worrying about what job they're going to have or like whether they're going to have enough money to support their family. So just like big worries and smaller worries. And they can be, you know, worry enough that it kind of disrupts they can't concentrate on school. So trouble concentrating, trouble sleeping, not being able to fall asleep or waking up, which is then, you know, aggravated with all the struggles with, you know, phones and screens. And then on the depression side, feeling hopeless, feeling bad about oneself, like you don't have much worth and feeling hopeless about the future. So that can all go together. And I think for teens, it's such a critical time where children move from primarily being identified with their parents and their family to their peers. And that was the very thing that kids kind of were most cut off from during the especially when schools were closed. And I think that's just really had a huge impact on teens. And at the same time, a lot of the ways that they would normally try to be more independent they could not be. Mm-hmm. And so I think all those things are aggravating a problem that was existing, and just making it more severe in this generation of kids.
Are you anticipating, or how are you anticipating, some of these issues that are coming up now being more sustained or long-term in a sort of chronic way?
Right. I mean, I try to be hopeful. I think that, again, these longer-term trends in anxiety and depression we'd already seen, and they're aggravated. And I think people are, on the positive side, the pandemic has brought them into focus. And schools have been investing more in mental health resources. I hear more and more from parents, and my son's own school screening for anxiety and depression, it's told us, having more programming around it, hiring more counselors. And so I think that could all be very positive to address something that was already a problem. And also another positive is to decrease stigma. I find that all the conversations we've been having about mental health, I've seen this in my own and the teens in my own family, that they're really open about things they struggle with in ways that no one was when I was their age. So I think that can all be very positive, as long as we continue, to give the resources that the kids need. And I also feel hopeful that over time, teens will also improve. It's just going to take, teens' lives are complicated, between peers and academic pressure, social stress, family, trying to be independent, that it may just take, hopefully it'll just take them more time. And if we can continue this move towards normalcy, that will, that will support their mental health.
When you look at the situation, and I wanted to ask about varying impacts. So in terms of like health and economics, COVID-19 has really disproportionately impacted communities of color. Are you seeing the same thing with mental health?
So we would expect, yeah, that's a good question. And I was actually looking to see what data we had on this. So we would expect to, because all the compounded experiences of kids in communities of colors, include, like what you mentioned, poverty and then discrimination, other adverse childhood experiences are all related to mental health problems in children. And also folks from those communities also tend to have fewer access to even more limited mental health resources. I mean, mental health resources are limited generally. And there has been a lot of reports on increases in stigma and discrimination, particularly against certain groups like Asian Americans during the pandemic, and that adverse effects on mental health. So we would expect to see a greater burden there. I would say that we have huge gaps in our research on communities of color, and also in many areas of the world, Africa, Latin America. There's sort of huge unknowns, particularly with regard to kids' mental health, because of the lack of studies and data.
Mm. What about globally? What do we know globally about trends amongst kids and mental health?
So luckily for that question, UNICEF just came out with a very large review of the literature, in which looked at something like data from like over 100,000 kids in different studies. And I think what I took away was many of the trends are consistent globally. The things that I mentioned we're seeing in younger kids and older kids, the increased problems among older kids in teens, also girls seem to be at higher risk, and all these other contributing factors, kids with prior problems or adverse childhood experiences have had more mental health problems during the pandemic. There's also huge gaps when they looked at where the studies were from. I think a quarter of them were from China, another quarter from the US, then a chunk from Europe. And I think from that review, there was maybe only one study from a low-income country, and that was from Ethiopia. Hmm. So the areas that things were studied were pretty consistent. One of the things that also came out was that some positives were reported, particularly around kids reporting liking more time with their family. And some kids who had prior problems said that the pandemic decreased their social and academic stress. So some of them seemed to be doing better. So it was not all negative. But again, it also speaks to the huge gaps in information we have about most kids around the world.
I would imagine with you know, economic stress and schools often being closed for really long periods of time, that that might create more vulnerabilities too for kids and right. a broader mental health crisis beyond just the US, it sounds like, but we still have to learn more.
Yes, yes, exactly. You would expect that. I mean, I know in one of my fellows is in South Africa right now on a Fulbright, and I know that they're talking, I don't know what happened, talking about having another lockdown there. And as different countries go through different waves, you know, there's school closures in some and that, and definitely we see that the, you know, school closures do tend to be adverse for kids' mental health wherever they occur. So each country is in its own, you know, in some sense its own wave, depending on where, when it gets hit with, you know, increases in cases.
Mm-hmm. We've gotten a lot of listener or viewer questions, so I want to get to a lot of those too. So I wanted to start with, this actually applies to what you were just saying, just kind of in a broad way. It comes from Liz. The pandemic's different from a lot of types of traumatic events, like certain natural disasters and terrorist attacks. You know, it's dragging on. There isn't necessarily a real endpoint. We have something like Omicron, you know, adding questions or uncertainties. How does that affect the impact on mental health, this kind of, we're not sure where things are going or ending. And does that require a different kind of response?
Yeah, that's a great question and something I think about a lot. So I think in the beginning, you know, back in, let's say, April of 2020, at least in, you know, in New England where I live, we were in this more kind of classic, you know, traumatic event where there was this really feeling of threat. And unpredictability and uncontrollability. People, I can remember like the runs on the grocery stores or like panic about, you know, washing down our groceries and really a more heightened fear kind of fight flight response. Mm-hmm. And since then, we're now in a more sort of chronically stressful state where things can be seen improving, and then something comes and that adds to the uncertainty and can disrupt our ability to plan and also make us question, like, you know, I was doing XYZ, now should I still go to the gym and things like that. And I think that the difference is that we need to accept that there's going to be this level of uncertainty probably for a while. And so it's a background chronic stressor that involves a certain amount of like cognitive load in terms of decisions we have to make every day. Decisions that were simple become more complicated. Think recognizing that sort of chronic stress that we're all experiencing, and some of us more than others. And the most important thing there is to keep your resources up. So taking care of yourself is like recognizing the stress, and you taking care of yourself physically, mm-hmm. And sleeping and eating and all those things, but also just, I think continuing to, when faced with your day, think about what are your priorities? What do you really need to do? And being, being sort of gentle on yourself and others. To recognize that this chronic, when you're under this kind of chronic stress, often you can't do everything that, you know, you would normally have done in December of 2019. So it may mean letting certain things go, and that's hard, but that may make your life a little bit, things that make your life more manageable. And I find with myself, I need to sort of recognize that, and sometimes, you know, move things around, cancel an appointment, move something, change a plan to just make it a little bit easier, to kind of reduce my stress, because I don't have any control over what variant appears or if there's going to be a change in policy at work about, you know, where we can go or what we can do. So I have to try to work on the things I can control in my own little life.
Mm-hmm. And recognizing that uncertainty.
Right. Yeah.
There's several questions coming in about vaccines. Mm-hmm. On the one hand, have vaccines like created a kind of assurance or shift for children and kind of the mental health and what that means? I'm just imagining, and you know, kids being worried about getting sick or being infected and other things. And I want to start with one question for Marty also. how are kids being impacted by what they're seeing in response by grownups, like when it comes to disputes over vaccines and other measures?
That's a great question.
So I just asked you two questions in one.
I think for, teens are their own. I have a teen, so I can say teens are their own kind of ball game. But for younger children, in terms of whether they're reassured or not, a lot of them will take the cues from their parents. If they've seen their parents' reassurance and their parents are getting the message that this is, getting vaccinated is positive and it will help them and it will enable them to see their grandparents, and they see that it will let them do things that they couldn't do. Maybe they can, like, once they're vaccinated, their parents will let them play with other vaccinated friends inside. Then that's, a huge positive and make them feel better. But it really will take cues from the environment, and also younger children it's very much about the immediate, like, how does it impact their lives, in a real way? Like, what can they do that they couldn't do? It's, not as, they don't have all the abstract pieces that we might have, or the things that are, we look at the future. And then I think, I was thinking about, we had a guest, Sherry Madigan, who studies mental health in kids on our forum. In her work, she follows a cohort, parental stress and conflict was the biggest contributor to adverse mental health in kids. Over screen time, which is the one we like to blame all the time, and sleep disruption. So it was actually parental stress and conflict, sleep disruption, and then screen time were three contributors. And so going back to the debates, I think that kids generally can find conflict that's heated and unresolved. If they see people disagreeing and resolving it or managing it, that can be a real positive, but like ongoing unresolved conflict that never ends is stressful for kids, whether it's between parents or, being exposed on the news. And I am a big advocate for really reducing the amount of news and things that your kids are exposed to, because it's so much of it is so fear-based for all of us. And it can be quite overwhelming for kids. That said, I know there's a lot you can't control as a parent. Your kid's gonna pick up news from their friends or on YouTube, and you can only do so much, but where you can control it, try to control it.
Yeah, so the family dynamics and parents actually, having a role in both the reactions and kind of reflectiveness of the stressors and conflicts. There's a lot of questions about resources and questions coming in around kind of responses, quite a few. One from Lynn is that Lynn is asking, I've noticed a lack of available pediatric psychiatrists, and I realize that the burden of treatment of the affected children is falling on pediatricians. And you mentioned earlier that, the lack of pediatric psychiatrists is not new. That was a concern before the pandemic. But as a group, I don't feel we've been well prepared for this role. So Lynn is a pediatrician. What can be done to bring pediatricians up to speed with diagnosing and treating and responding to a new wave of pediatric needs?
That is a great question. And I think I was sharing with Alana and I were talking before this about in my own family, some teens have struggled and trying. So me helping them get mental health care, and obviously I know people, and it was incredibly challenging. And I do think much of this is falling on pediatricians. And actually, we have a great pediatrician who's been really good with these. So I think offering easily accessible, practical training to pediatricians and how to screen, what to look for, what are the most common, common symptoms, anxiety, depression. And then programs, for example, in Massachusetts, there is a program by which pediatricians can link with consultation services with psychiatry, which then can allow them to more quickly, for example, prescribe an antidepressant for a kid. And so those kinds of programs, that's a Massachusetts program. I don't know how common that is in other states, but the whole point is to increase access to psychiatric care through the pediatrician's office. And then I think another piece along those lines is training pediatricians in a more stepped care model. So they identify a kid who's, you know, having depression, anxiety, distress, what are the main things they can do to help support that child's coping strategies? So for example, one of the things we know is really important is sleep. So is there things they can work with the child and the parent around improving sleep routines? And sometimes those things that sound pretty basic can be incredibly helpful to kids. So another thing we found in research is that just general family routines, having structures, improves kids' mental health. So, you know, asking parents, you know, what's gotten disrupted, and there are ways that they can reintroduce some of those structures. So are there things that the pediatrician can do that are practical? But then they do really need access to these other services and consultations to be able to do more advanced care that involves, for example, medication. And then finally, we had a huge gap in mental health services for kids before the pandemic. And that has just, that existed before. It's probably worse now. And it is true, waiting lists are very long, often 6 months. And so that really, that's a system problem that we as a society need to address, that, you know, I hope the attention that's bringing to it now will help us address it. But it's really it's a system problem that it really leaves parents and pediatricians and schools in a really tough spot.
What about online, like web-based programs? Mm-hmm. Are there useful things out there? Obviously, it's not necessarily replacement, but what do we know about those options and how helpful that might be?
Yeah, so I think they have a lot of promise, and especially that there's different apps for, you know, anything. I mean, we've heard about Calm, Headspace, all kinds of things. And there is some data in adults that these completely online, so not just online therapy, talking to a therapist, but online programs actually are effective. We need more research, but there is some evidence. There actually is really almost no studies in kids. When I was looking, I found one study from New Zealand that used an app that was designed for the local population. And they found some good evidence that was helpful in supporting kids' mental health. But there's a huge gap there, which I think is remarkable given how much time our kids spend online. It seems like a lot more could be done. And there's other studies that have shown that sort of meditation can help decrease anxiety and depression in kids separately. So it seems like there might be an enormous opportunity there that we could, you know, make better use of, for sure.
I wanted to transition to this question from Carol. So, I mean, it sounds like there's a bit of caution around it, but it could be helpful as people are looking right now. You know, so much of life has moved online during the pandemic, like, you know, with FaceTime and Zoom. But we know there can be a dark side sometimes to these online interactions. And what have you learned about the impact of going online socially, and what parents and kids can do to strike the right balance for their mental
health? It's such a mixed bag. I think that, I mean, in some ways, can you imagine having gone through this if we didn't have Zoom or FaceTime, or, you know, it's just, or, you know, for my son, multiplayer video games online, like that was the main way of connecting with friends. And I never thought I'd be like, oh, it's great, he's playing video games. But I was. So I think there's been a huge positive. And then I think the downside is that we, you know, we've shifted so much online that we actually have to consciously go offline. And whether it's as an adult, you know, it's really easy for me to stay home, to not go in the office, and just Zoom for all my meetings. And it takes more effort to go in, but I actually always feel better when I actually see people in person, but it takes the effort. So some of it is being conscious that it does take the extra effort to do things in person and kind of make ourselves do that. The other piece is, I think, thinking about, instead of having just thinking about screen time as all, I think before the pandemic, I would have thought of it as all like, all right, how much, it's sort of like all a negative almost, like how much am I going to let him have? And now thinking more about like, what is it being used for? What's the purpose? Is it increasing social connection or is it increasing stress? And I think that's very individual for parents and children, but I think engaging with that with your child and then using that to set up what the rules are around it mm-hmm. is important. I think we moved away from where we could be like, oh, it's just going to be, you know, no screen times, but the weekends or something. It's sort of becoming so integrated into our lives that now we have to kind of rethink and also recognize the positives that kids get out of it. And then I think also get like as adults, you know, it's we at our family's dinners over Thanksgiving, my mom's always like, no phones, you know, we all separately in our own families, but together, no phones at dinner, say. But you know, and so of course the teens are, you know, getting in trouble because they sneak their phone. But there's many an adult at the dinner who's also like looking at their phone. So I think also as parents, looking at what our habits are and what, you know, it really doesn't work to be like, don't do what I, you know, do what I say, not what I do kind of situation. And so kind of examining our own habits, and I had to do that myself too, so that I, you know, I'm practicing a little bit what I preach here.
There's a lot of other questions. I hope you can stand for a little bit, for a few. I might jump around a little bit, yeah. But this question is from Vanessa. And you know, when we were talking about what to look out for, signs of depression and anxiety, she writes that, I've noticed many teens coming in with physical manifestations of their anxiety. So IBS, fibromyalgia, eczema. And I know that that's such like a tricky line of what is in your head versus like physical, like all, it's tricky. And the question is, what's the most effective way to assess the connection between physical and mental health symptoms? And when is it something that has a real root in chronic anxiety and something that's been happening with the pandemic? Are there effective ways to unpack this?
Yeah, that's a great question. It's actually one of my most, the areas of research I'm most interested in is the intersection of mental and physical health. And the first thing I want to say is that there is no separation between our brain and our body. So our brain is in our body and the two are completely connected. We talk about something called the brain-gut axis. Our brain is connected to our stomach. And so it's all connected. That's just a start. So I recognize the sensitivity because you don't want to be like, oh, your stomach pumps are all. So I think that, and a lot of people, adults and children, and especially younger children also can manifest their emotions in physical pain. Also headaches is common, or you know, aches and pains, it's stomach, as you said. So I think one is, you know, not taking the physical complaint seriously. And you know, addressing that directly, whether
taking it seriously.
Okay. I mean, addressing it, you know, not dismissing it. So taking it, you know, finding out, asking all the questions. If it's stomach, you know, helping the person, it's stomach pains. You know, is there a pattern? Does it seem to be all the questions? Like, is it linked to certain foods? Is it every Monday? You know. Because they're going back to school. So looking for patterns in relation to health behaviors, as well as other things going on that may show it's for anxiety. So like, you know, I've noticed, I don't know, I talked to the nurse at my son's school, for example, and she notices that, you know, a lot of kids seem to come in with stomach aches on Monday when school, you know, it's back to school, or during exam time. And using that real concrete information to talk to the kids like, about what you're observing. You know, I've noticed that you seem to come in whenever you have, you know, exams, you think that your stress is contributing, or it could be during exam time, they're eating a lot of junk food, which is upsetting their stomach. So there's not some straightforward way. There's not some like magic formula, but I think it takes a lot of conversation and examination with the child or the teen and the parents to look at routines, what might be contributing. And then also, you know, following up if there's a more serious concern, like stomach pains that are leading to weight loss, than making sure you follow up properly medically. But it's very common in adults too. And the fact is, if kids who have pain or IBS, that can make them anxious, which then worsens their symptoms. So it goes back and forth, which is the hard part.
Mm. I want to just wrap up with a couple questions about resources again. Mm-hmm. You know, you mentioned in the very beginning that supporting schools and resources is a really important thing. Like, are you seeing, you know, Albert has asked, you know, my child school district is performing mental health screenings for everyone, and the district's added more counseling and guidance staff. Are we going to be seeing schools playing a bigger role in the future and from now on?
That is actually terrific to hear, because one of the things I worry about in mental health, we sort of have a principle, you don't screen for something that you're not going to address. Mm. So I do sometimes worry that, you know, we do all this mental health screening and then it's like, okay, what do we do? So a school that is phenomenal, a school that's doing that and then has put more resources in place to follow up, that's important. And I think in thinking of schools, one of the ways like to think about it is, we know that keeping schools open is better. It's on average, it's better for most kids' mental health. So what do schools need to keep them open? Mm. Rather than being, you know, schools need to be open, but what are the resources they need? And I think they can be resources related to the infectious part of the pandemic, like testing and masks and all the kinds of things that can make
filtering and
care. Yes, filtering. Kids feel, the parents and the kids and the teachers feel safe, which will reduce their stress and support their mental health. And then they can be these other resources, whether it's screening, having counselors, making sure the teachers are trained to understand, to recognize mental health problems. You don't want it to fall on teachers to treat them. That's not the teacher's job. But if they see some, you know, what they should notice that they might want to tell the counselor about or talk to a parent about. So I think all those ways we can support schools would, you know, will be good for kids' mental health and really good for their education, actually, in the longer term.
Are there movements? This is a question from Chuck, and it makes me think of some global models about training a lot of paraprofessionals, mm-hmm. like mental health specialists or providers that would be able to respond to and support children and provide services that could be reimbursable. Are there moves to look at that?
Yes. I mean, I think that that's something that's been very big in more global mental health work for decades. And my colleague at Harvard, Vikram Patel, has led a lot of that work, which is task shifting. So shifting skills, intervention or mental health work from a psychiatrist, psychologist to a community health worker. Exactly, or paraprofessional. And then other models have been used, not in young kids so much, but in older kids, in young adults, peer-based models, training peers to deal. So that is something. It hasn't, the leap we haven't made in the US, as far as I know, is doing that in a way that's reimbursable. And I think that's the next leap we need to make. And making it more integrated into the health system. So these models, they exist with peers, or they might be, you know, a school or a district may roll these out, but generally not within the insurance system or the healthcare system as we, you know, operate in the US. And I think that we actually have a lot to learn from how these models have been successful in low and middle income countries. And we have a lot to learn that could be actually really useful here. So I think that would be terrific. I hope we see some move. We've seen some changes in insurance with the pandemic in terms of, you know, being able to bill for online support and phone treatment. So, you know, hopefully there'll be further changes that make mental health care more accessible.
We have a few more questions. I hope.
Sure. Let's keep going.
Or transition. This is something we haven't discussed, but in terms of, you know, this has been a mental health crisis has been discussed as we kick things off with anxiety and stress rising for children or depression amongst some. What about the effect of the loss of a loved one? So many kids have been affected and families by the death of a loved one. And what are you finding with that and loss and grief and that impact and the supports or lack thereof.
No, thank you for asking. And also that has really disproportionately impacted communities of color. It's childhood bereavement is historically been greater among communities of color, Black and Latinx communities and Indigenous communities in the US. And that's also been true during compounded during COVID. And so there is the emotional part, as you mentioned, the grief and loss and those mental health effects. But there's also all these other downstream effects which have long-term implications for children's well-being and mental health. So for example, there's been studies that show that kids who are bereaved have lower educational attainment. You often have, and especially true if you're already in an under-resourced community, you may lose the only person who provided income. And so it can really put families in precarious positions financially, which then adds stress, which then impacts kids' mental health. And so it can have so many adverse effects, including the actual pure emotional part of losing the relationship with the person. That I do think it's something that I hope to see we develop more policies to address, whether it's, you know, leave policies for family members who've lost someone to help care for kids. But also I have a colleague who studies this, and she's pointed out to me that in some places, children who lost a parent get an orphan pension. So there's policies where that income loss from the parent is supported. So it's just kind of prevent some of those other adverse consequences. So it's huge. And I think we'll see the impact. This will be something we'll see impacting for a long time. And again, particularly hits the least resourced communities the hardest. Mm-hmm. They were also the most affected by COVID deaths. So really a big area of concern.
This question's from Paul. Within the response to supporting children with mental health needs or just the general well-being, we also talked about in the beginning of this conversation how there is like uncertainty in this pandemic, and there's like a prolonged nature to some of the stress. That can be a real stress. The chronic stress can be a stress on the caregivers and yes. The parents and teachers. And so what are they going through right now? And what are the ways to address the challenges they may be facing, like with burnout?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and as a parent myself, I can really feel this. My son's a teenager, so I don't have the stress of having a young child. But so I think I could talk about all the self-care things one can do, which I can mention. But I think going back to, you know, when I was saying about schools, like what resources do schools need to stay open? I think what resources do parents need to, to be able to manage their own stress. And I think, you know, one of the areas that we don't think about as a mental health intervention, but it definitely supports mental health, is financial support and resources. So interventions at the policy level that help protect people's jobs and homes and incomes will help reduce family stress and will protect parents and kids' mental health. So that's one set of things. And I think, you know, keeping schools and childcare open also reduces parent stress, working parent stress. So then how do we do that? So I think we have a lot on us as a society that we need to do to support schools and families and kids. And then that said, I think that, I go back to like Sherry Madigan's work, which showed that, you know, parental stress and distress and conflict was one of the biggest predictors of, you know, adverse mental health outcomes in the kids. So all the things that it's really hard as a parent to prioritize your own mental health. I know that from, you know, especially my son was young, and doing all the things, whether it's trying to get enough sleep or exercising or seeing friends and doing things that, you know, kind of reward you and fill you up and give you energy when you have such limited time. But as much as you can squeeze those things in, whether it's you know, if there's a meeting at work, you can do on your phone and go walk around outside, or, you know, pushing yourself to, you know, go see a friend. Even if it's like, go walk with a friend or do something, you know, I'm trying to think of things that are quick, or it's like, you know, taking, you know, 15 minutes to, you know, close the door and take a hot shower by yourself without someone banging on it. You know, sometimes that's hard when your kids are little or impossible. So it's, you know, it is a real challenge, but sometimes as parents, we can do things if we know they're good for our kids. We might not do them just because they're good for us, but there is just a lot of data that if you can manage and reduce your own stress, that will really help your kids. So, you know, maybe that will help some of us prioritize.
I think this is a good place to wrap up, but I wanted to see what your biggest takeaways are in this moment and moving forward to do the most to kind of buffer children and create a supportive future for them.
I mean, my, you know, going back to being optimistic, we've had having worked in mental health for my whole career, I've never had so many conversations or seen so much media or seen so much discussion just in, you know, regular people in my family around mental health or as much openness. And I feel incredibly optimistic about that. And what I'm hoping is that that is translated into high level recognition and policy at the national level. You know, sometimes they say, you know, we have a climate czar. What about a mental health czar? Mm. Because there's huge policy and systemic needs in this area that the pandemic has brought to bear. And I think there's many people working on that, and there's so much attention that I feel really hopeful there might be real systemic change. So I think that's something I feel really positive and hopeful about. And then the other piece on a more personal level is, you know, we've all been doing the best we can. And, you know, I feel like I've seen a lot of, despite all the stress and all the, you know, demands that everyone's been under, I've seen a remarkable amount of people trying to, you know, help each other, whether it's like in my building or friends or neighbors at the school, trying to support each other. And I think that is also, despite all the, you know, all the challenges we're facing, that also is encouraging. So I do feel hopeful that in the longer term, that this will produce some real, real positive changes in terms of our mental health system and the care we give to kids.
That was Karisten Konen, a psychiatric epidemiologist at Harvard's T.H. Chan School of Public Health. This Q&A was jointly presented by the Forum at Harvard's T.H. Chan School of Public Health and us here at The World. You can view the video of this conversation at our Facebook page. You can find that at theworld.org/Facebook. And see more from the series at theworld.org/coronavirus-conversations. Thanks for listening.